Right now, you're listening to Bush Telegraph around Australia on RN and across Asia and the Pacific on Radio Australia. You'll often hear this from travellers, that the world's cities are becoming the same. The same chain stores selling the same brands, the buildings all look the same, and even the local television shows are often part of a global franchise. This decline in diversity is also happening in food. Wheat, maize and soybean crops are replacing millet, sorghum and rice. The report Increasing Homogeneity found the trends towards a Western diet has big implications for nutrition and food security. Colin Currie from the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture says all nations are coming together towards a global average diet, and he told Greg Muller this trend has developed over the past 50 years.
Generally around the world, all nations are coming together towards what you might call a global average diet. What we did in our research is we looked at diets around the world at the national level. That is, for each country, what kind of crops are people eating and how much of each crop are people eating in their diet. And that dietary contribution was the calories, or protein, fat, overall weight in the diet. And what we found is that around the world, people are starting to eat more and more of the same crops, with a particular group of crops becoming more and more important.
So what's driven that?
What's driven it is a complicated group of a number of factors that all come together. What I understand is that rising incomes around the world, that's greater purchasing power. This is as a global trend, so especially in areas where people didn't have as much purchasing power in the past, are able to access a greater amount of food. Meanwhile, people are moving into the cities, they're urbanizing. That means they have less gardens, they have less access to wild plants, they eat out more, they have access to supermarkets, they eat fast food, and they cook less at home, they have less time for cooking at home. Another aspect is globalization in its broad sense, which means a greater amount of food, ideas, cultures moving around the globe. That also entails freer trade agreements between countries of moving goods and commodities. It means supermarkets, global supermarkets or global food industries entering countries.
But are we just choosing the crop varieties that are giving higher yields? Considering we have to feed, 9 billion people by 2050, aren't we just selecting the crops that are most likely able to give us that?
Yes, absolutely. I do think that that's part of it. If you consider that the great majority of research investment, both from the public sector and from the private sector, has gone into a couple of select crops in the last 50 years, particularly soybean, maize, wheat and rice, sugar to some degree, we've been phenomenally successful at making those crops more productive and in the end cheaper to people. And the greatest trend that we saw in our research was really the oil crops, particularly soybean, palm oil. These are crops that basically didn't exist at the global level 50 years ago and have become vital parts of the diet because they're cheap plant fats for cooking mostly. Now, when you ask whether we're only choosing because they're more productive, I think it's also the other direction. They're more productive because we put a lot of energy into them. And I would guess that if we put a lot more energy into alternative crops, we could actually have some pretty quick high gains in those alternative crops as well. It's a matter of priorities, really.
So as we see the globe moving towards a more Western environment, you're right that Western health problems are spreading globally as well. Like you say, the number of overnourished now has surpassed the number of undernourished people.
Yeah, quite a change, really, a historical change in the world.
Why is that the case?
Underneath, or one could say above this trend that we see in changes in crops, is the larger trend that people are eating overall more food. That is more calories, more fat, more protein. And within that, they tend to be eating more energy-dense food. That's high fat, high sugar, high calorie food. What that means is that the over amount of energy in the body is more, and if we're not burning it off, we store that as fat and we become obese. And then we end up with an increased likelihood of dietary-related diseases of cholesterol and diabetes and heart disease. We think that these trends that we're seeing in terms of crops, this narrowing and increased homogeneity of particular crops, is only going to increase the likelihood of that similar pattern happening. And this pattern, I should mention, is not just a pattern of countries, the United States, Australia, the UK, that have experienced these nutrition transition for quite a long time. It's everywhere now. In Nigeria, in China, there are issues even in the same regions, the same communities, where we have issues of dietary disease from overnutrition just as much as from undernutrition.
Well, I was shocked to read that what wheat is one of the most prominent foods in 97% of countries.
Yeah, pretty phenomenal.
So what are the grains that we're not growing now? What are we missing out on?
So the greatest change in diets around the world that we've seen have been in sub-Saharan Africa and in East Asia. And in sub-Saharan Africa, we can talk about these regionally important grains. These are sorghum, the millets, as well as tuber crops such as yams, sweet potatoes. These are the sort of crops that used to be quite important, and they're still around, but they become more marginalized. They're less important in the diet as some of these other commodities have gained importance. In East Asia, we see some of these same processes, for instance, with sweet potato declining, some of the millets, but we also see rice itself becoming a little less important in the diet in East Asia as wheat and potatoes and other of the main globalized commodities come in.
So what about vegetables?
They mostly stay about the same. They're not declining highly, they're not increasing highly, but around them, the oil crops and these particular cereals like wheat and maize are increasing in abundance greatly.
What's the role of multinational food organizations then in standardizing our food?
Multinational food organizations have done considerable work in moving new products, and I think particularly processed products around the world. And that's brought food that's can often be cheaper and also easier to cook or process to more people, available in supermarkets. And so people will eat products, and they have some crops within them that they know about. Maybe it's a tomato sauce and it's got tomato, and it also has some other products that we might not be as aware of what's in them. That might be sugar that comes from maize, it might be soybean oil, and that all builds up, of course, in the diet. It adds up to a diet where we're eating more soy or more maize than we thought.
The other outcome of us all eating the same thing is we have less diversity of microbacteria in our gut.
Yeah, this is an interesting trend that's being seen in the literature. They've been able to look at people's remains over time, as well as modern history of gut diversity or tooth diversity, as mouth diversity, and see that changes in our diets over time, particularly in eating, let's say, simpler foods, that is, more sugary foods, more simple carbohydrates, has changed the balance of organisms, both in the gut and in the mouth, both to some negative degree.
What do you mean negative degree? Why is this a bad thing?
As an ecologist, how I understand this trend is that whether it's in one's mouth, whether it's in one's stomach, whether it's in a natural system or an agroecosystem, a balance of diversity, that is some level of numerous amount of species, creates a balance that creates resilience in the system. When one has only one or a few species, it's more vulnerable to change. If some big change happens, a diet that is higher in sugar seems to end up with bacteria and microbiota that are abundantly dominated by types that eat those sugars. And that system is less balanced and less resilient in the end to change.
I guess likewise, focusing on fewer crop varieties, we're opening ourselves to be more vulnerable to diseases or drought.
This is our main implication coming from an agricultural research institute, is that necessarily if we're eating more of the same types of crops around the world, the same crop species, then necessarily in our agricultural systems, we're growing more of those crops. And that means we're either producing them at home and eating them more, or we're importing them. In either case, in the global sum, it's less diversity in global production areas. And that means greater vulnerability to major pest and disease outbreaks. And so we think that if we're going to grow a less diversity of crop species, it's ever more important to have diversity within those crops. That is, many varieties grown with distinct characteristics, so that the kind of episodes that we learned from, hopefully, in the Irish potato famine, in the southern corn leaf blight in the United States in the 70s, where we had only a few varieties being grown and they were highly susceptible to certain pests, so that sort of event won't happen again. And of course, if that event happened again, the more and more people relying on those sort of systems, the more are going to be affected. I was thinking today about the Ukraine and reading about it. And the Ukraine is one of the largest exporters in the world of wheat and maize. And so not only is this an issue, of course, of pests and diseases and diversity, but if we're relying more and more on particular crops, it also means we're relying on a global system of being having those available to us. And if our third largest or so provider of those sort of crops has instability within it and are unable to produce as they were, then we may end up with higher food prices, unavailability of those sort of crops.
You're listening to Bush Telegraph, and my guest is Colin Currie, who's just co-authored a report, Increasing the Homogeneity in Global Food Supplies, the Implication for Food Security. With fewer and fewer crop varieties on the menu globally, what this means for our health and our agricultural systems. Colin, what's the role of climate change?
The science is clear at this point that climate change is affecting agricultural systems and will in the future. And of course, it's not just the changes in temperatures and precipitation in their own right. It's combined with all these other really significant challenges to agriculture in the coming time. That's more people needing to be fed. That's less available land to expand our agricultural areas. That's resource limitations like phosphorus limitations and water limitations. So together with climate change, there's very significant factors affecting the ability to increase our yields in the world in the coming time. And if we're going to rely more and more on these particular crops, once again, it looks like genetic diversity within the crops is really where we need to focus in terms of trying to keep those crops both resilient but also try to increase yields.
One solution often put up for agricultural pests or drought or lower yields has been genetic modification of crops. What's your view on that?
It's a powerful technique that has potential. What remains to be seen is how that technique is used. What's fairly clear, I think, is that genetic engineering is not a panacea. It's not going to be the solution. And there are cases where we're moving traits from other species can be very powerful and very useful. There was actually a report that came out last week that was the movement of traits resistant to potato blight into a potato variety, and that has been worked on, basically since the Irish potato famine. And they've had some success finally using some of these techniques, but it certainly has potential to help us if we direct research funds that way.
With certain varieties patented, does that add to this problem of standardization?
Or I would rather say, and thank you for bringing that up because it comes back to the same point. One of the main issues, though, with genetic engineering or patenting in the overlap is that we are ending up with agriculture being more and more dominated by certain multinational organizations that are doing a lot of the research and owning a lot of the seed. And those organizations are playing their part in feeding the world. But what it can mean is that we may end up with a greater amount of the same varieties, very successful varieties with good traits in them, being grown over larger areas. And that success may create in and of itself a vulnerability. And if we're not aware of that vulnerability and continue to create new varieties, a more diverse amount of varieties, then we may end up in trouble.
We've got quite a trajectory we're heading in now. What would you like to see?
This is an excellent question. What's interesting about the trend that we see is that we're clearly heading in a direction of increasingly similar diets around the world. But I don't think we're going to end up with a static point in which we're all really eating the same thing. It's unlikely to ever arrive at that point, but also in some regions of the world, we're already seeing something else happening, this change. And particularly in Northern Europe and Scandinavia, some isolated pockets in the United States, I'm sure in Australia, where people are making the connection between their diets and diet-related disease, and they're starting to eat a wider range of diet with a greater amount of vegetables and cereals and less oils and fat. And the big question is, how are they doing that? And how can the rest of the world learn from that before we end up with such high level of epidemics of diet-related disease? There is, in the case of Scandinavia at least, there's good evidence that policy has been important in making diverse food cheaper and making imported, unhealthier food a little bit more expensive. And that's a little bit more difficult to imagine that sort of policy being as extensively done in the United States, perhaps in Australia, because There are different views on how much politics should enter the market. But I can see a role to play to also try to encourage as much as possible a wider diversity of food available to people. And also, of course, to really invest in alternative crops.
Colin Currie from the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture, based in Colombia, speaking there to Greg Muller. That study was published in the National Academy of Sciences, and we'll make sure there's a link to that up on the Bush Telegraph website this afternoon.